I have a few announcements to give before the start of service. Have you ever wondered how you can help with the life of this church and how to get to know other members? You can do both by signing up for a church committee. There will be a sign-up after today's service in the social hall. Only those committees that still need help are posted. This year, there is a new volunteer activity. It is helping with the kitchen cleanup after the social hour on Sunday because we are no longer hiring a cleanup person to do this for us. You can sign up at the table after the service. We also have the LCUUC helping tree, and each classroom will have a tree on the wall with leaves that have small tasks written on them. The idea is for a child to partner up with a person from another generation and work together to ensure that our church home is cared for as we grow. After the task is completed, the leaf will go on the big helping tree in the social hall. So don't be surprised if a child comes up to you after the service and asks you to help them complete a task for just a couple of minutes. Thank you for your help in this. And also, a big announcement is that we have our potluck after the service, so everyone, please feel welcome to join us.
Take my hand and we will close our eyes and guide each other home, because we are so nearly there. No matter how far you are, they say, home knows no race, no distance. Home is fair. Home is at the end of war. Home is in the peaceful sun. It is in the morning breeze. It is where we all begin. Home is as unique as each of us, and yet the same. A place beyond building or name, a place that when we go, we know we are there in the center of our soul. Home is in a lover's arms. Home is between these doors. Home is in a child's laughter. Home is where you make it yours. Welcome here and welcome home. Come, let us worship here together. Would you please take a moment this morning to say hello or to introduce yourself to the people around you?
Serve as a light for our path and lead us to where we are welcomed, accepted, and loved.
Please stand in body or spirit and join in singing our opening hymn, number 298, Wake Now My Senses. Spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Laura Levenhagen, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation,
We hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey, and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service, and please join us in the potluck as well. Also, there is a welcome table at the back of the church where you can find out more about LCUUC. Today's order service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to all of our visitors, friends, and members joining in. Please take a moment at this point in the service to silence all electronics so that you may have here with you today. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We are so pleased that you've chosen us to celebrate and worship with us this morning.
I was thinking about our giving today, and I remembered a story I heard a long time ago about a young minister who wanted nothing more than to give to others so much that he spent every penny the church collected in giving to charity. In doing so, he did not take care of himself, and he let his own clothing and his own house go to rags and ruin. And one day he collected a large amount of money to help the poor, and he shoved it in his pocket, and he ran to deposit it in the bank. But when he got there, he found that the rotten cloth in his pocket had ripped, and the money had fallen out on the road. It isn't possible to help those around us or to help our community unless we take care of ourselves first. So please, help us to keep our pants intact as we work to take care of others in our world. The morning offering will now be given and received. Our thanks for these gifts given and received for the life and the work of this community. One of the ways that we care for our neighbors and ourselves is by contributing to the local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate once a month to various pantries. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward or ask a child to bring them forward for you, and I invite the children to stay up front for a story. This morning's story is called The Three Little Wolves and the Big Bad Pig. Once upon a time, there were three cuddly little wolves with soft black fur and big fluffy tails who lived with their mom. The first was black, the second gray, and the third white. And one day, the mother called the three little wolves to her and said, "It's time for you to go out into the world. Go and build a house, but beware of the big bad pig." The wolf said, "Don't worry, Mom. We'll watch out for him." And they set off. Soon they met a kangaroo who was pushing a wheelbarrow full of red and yellow bricks. "Can we have some of your bricks?" asked the wolves. "Sure," said the kangaroo, and she gave them lots of them. So they built themselves a house of brick. The very next day, the big bad pig came prowling down the road and saw the house. The wolves were playing in the garden, and when they saw the big bad pig coming, they ran inside and they locked the door. The pig knocked and grunted and said, little wolves, let me come in." "Oh, no, 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 not by the hair on our chinny chin chins," said the little wolves. "Well, then I'll huff and puff and blow your house down," said the pig. He huffed and puffed and huffed, but the house didn't fall down. But the pig wasn't called big and bad for nothing. He went and fetched a sledgehammer, and he knocked the house down. Well, the three little wolves just barely managed to get out before the house collapsed, and they were a little worried. "We'll have to build a better house," they said. Just then they saw a beaver who was mixing concrete in a concrete mixer. "Can we have some of your concrete?" asked the wolves. "Sure," said the beaver, and he gave them buckets and buckets full of messy, slurpy concrete. So they built themselves a concrete house. But no sooner had they finished than the big bad pig came prowling down the road and saw the new house. They were playing in the garden when they saw him coming, and they ran in and shut the door. The pig rang the bell and said, "Little frightened wolves, let me in." "Uh-uh," said the wolves. "By the hair on our chinny chin chins, we will not let you in." "Then I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down," said the pig. Well, he huffed and he puffed, but the house was concrete. It didn't fall down. But he wasn't called big and bad for nothing. He went and got a jackhammer, and he knocked the house down. Well, the three little wolves managed to get out, but they were pretty scared. "We'll build an even bigger house," they said, because they were very determined and not very bright. Just then, they saw a truck coming along with barbed wire, iron bars, armor plates, and metal padlocks. "Please, can we have your stuff?" they said to the rhinoceros who was driving the truck. "Sure," said the rhinoceros, and he gave them barbed wire, iron bars, armor plates, heavy metal padlocks. He also gave them plexiglass and reinforced steel chains because he was just a good guy like that. So the three little wolves built themselves the strongest house ever. They felt absolutely safe. And the next day, the big pig came prowling along, and they were playing in the garden. And when they saw him, they ran in the house, and they locked all 37 padlocks. And the pig dialed the secure video entrance camera,
And he said, "Little scared wolves, let me in." "Oh, no," said the little wolves, "not by the hair on our chinny chin chins." "Then I'll huff and puff and blow your house down," said the pig. Well, he huffed and he puffed. Nothing happened. But he wasn't called big and bad for nothing. He ran out and got some dynamite. He put it against the house, lit the fuse, and the house blew up. And the three little wolves just managed to escape with their fluffy tails scorched. "Well, something must be wrong with our building. We have to try something different," they said. And at that moment, they saw a pretty pink flamingo coming along, pushing a wheelbarrow full of flowers. "Would you give us some flowers?" asked the little wolves. "Sure," said the flamingo. So the three little wolves tried again, and this time they built a house out of flowers. Purple and yellow and gold and pink. The ceiling was sunflowers and the floor daisies. Water lilies in the bathtubs and buttercups in the refrigerator. It wasn't a very strong house, but it looked very pretty. Well, the next day, the big bad pig came prowling along and saw the house of flowers. He poked at the bluebell at the door and yelled, "Ding dong, little weird wolves, can I come in?" No, said the little wolves, "not by the hair on our chinny chin chins." The pig was a little confused. He said, "Well, I'll huff and puff and blow this down." So he took a deep breath, ready to huff and puff, and he puffed, and the flowers just swayed. And he took another deep breath, and this time he smelled the flowers, and they smelled pretty good. So he took another breath, and then another, and then he started to sniff, and he realized, "I've been pretty rotten. I can't blow this house down, and it smells pretty good. Wow, it smells great." And he started to grin, and the little wolves started to look. They weren't real sure about this. It might be a trick. But then they realized the pig was really enjoying their house. They came out one after the other, and they asked him if he wanted to play. So they played pig pong and piggy in the middle, and when they were tired, they got brave and said, "Hey, you just want to come in?" And they gave him strawberries and wolfberries, and they asked him to stay and play as much as he wanted. The pig wasn't real sure about this, but he accepted. And they all lived happily ever after. Thank you for listening to my story. Would you all help me in singing the children out? The words "To Go Now in Peace" are in your order of service. The time in our service where we share our joys and concerns. We do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. Would anyone who has a joy or a sorrow to share, please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
Good morning, I'm Claire Wagner. This is my husband, Chris Wagner. And I want to say what a joy it is to be here from St. John's Unitarian Universalist Church, where we ordained Amy last April.
This is Jerry. Would you light a candle of joy for the work party of eight hardy souls that were over here yesterday morning digging holes and pouring concrete for the supports for our porches and patching the bridges? My back will never be the same.
My name is Bud Hudson, my wife Sarah, and good friends to you and me to Martin. May we join together in sympathy and support for the people of Kenya and the tragedy that they just incurred, and with the people of Syria. And let's remind ourselves that that great big pig can be changed to a peaceful pig, but it takes ongoing efforts. May we do that.
I'm going to add a quick one here. I'd like to light a candle of joy for all those who worked so hard yesterday to refurbish our fire pit and to put up our sukkah. What a joy it was to be with them last night. So thank you, and just wonderful.
Hello, everyone. Maddie. I'm back in town for a week celebrating my engagement with my fiancée, Molly.
I'm Barbara, and I'm Barbara, and I'd like you to light a candle of joy first for the fact that I had that second knee done, and I had the knee replaced again, and it is so great, and I'm having the other one done at the end of October. So, but boy, great difference. I'm not in the pain I used to be in with that. It is so wonderful. But please also light a candle of concern for my neighbor, Janet. She has cancer, stage 4 kidney cancer, and she's fading on a daily basis. She's still living at home. She's a brave soul. She lives alone. She's just wonderful, and please keep her in your prayers and anything else you can send to her. Energy, light, please. Thank you.
I'm Sam Butts from Gainesville, Florida, here with my wife, Susan, visiting our daughter and her husband, Paul Atkinson, and their children, and my happiest times are seeing my wife happy, and this is a happy time.
Hi, I'm Janice, and if you'd light a candle of hope for our Pope, I think Pope Francis is standing on the side of love, so thanks.
And we light the last candle today for all those joys and all those sorrows which are deeply held, but which have not been named here.
Our first reading today is an excerpt from author Hermann Hesse. Hesse was a German-born Swiss poet, novelist, and painter. His best-known works include Steppenwolf, Siddhartha, and The Glass Bead Game, each of which explores an individual's path for authenticity, self-knowledge, and spirituality. In 1946, he received the Nobel Prize in Literature. From Hesse's Trees, Reflections and Poems. Trees are sanctuaries. Whoever knows how to speak to them, whoever knows how to listen to them, can learn the truth. They do not preach learning and precepts. They preach, undeterred by particulars, the ancient law of life. A tree says, a kernel is hidden in me, a spark, a thought. I am life from eternal life. The attempt and the risk that the eternal mother took with me is unique. Unique the form and veins of my skin. Unique the smallest play of leaves in my branches and the smallest scar on my back. I was made to form and reveal the eternal in my smallest special detail. A tree says, my strength is trust. I know nothing about fathers. I know nothing about the thousand children that every year spring out of me. I live out the seed, the secret of my seed, to the very end, and I care for nothing else. I trust that God is in me. I trust that my labor is holy. Out of this trust I live. When we are stricken and cannot bear our lives any longer, then a tree has something to say to us. Be still. Be still. Look at me. Life is not easy. Life is not difficult. Those are childish thoughts. Let God speak within you, and your thoughts will grow silent. You are anxious because your path leads away from mother and home. But every step and every day leads you back again to the mother. Home is neither here nor there. Home is within you, or home is nowhere at all. A longing to wander tears my heart when I hear trees rustling in the wind at evening. If one listens to them silently for a long time, this longing reveals its kernel, its meaning. It is not so much a matter of escaping from one's suffering, though it may seem to be so. It is a longing for home, for a memory of our mother, for new metaphors for life. It leads home. Every path leads homeward. Every step is birth. Every step is death. Every grave is mother. So the tree rustles in the evening when we stand uneasy before our own childish thoughts. Trees have long thoughts, long breathing and restful, just as they have longer lives than ours. They are wiser than us as long as we do not listen to them. But when we have learned how to listen to the trees, then the brevity and the quickness and the childlike hastiness of our thoughts achieve an incomparable joy. Whoever has learned how to listen to trees no longer wants to be a tree. He wants to be nothing except what he is. This is home. This is happiness.
We built this house from its foundation. Its foundation we made strong so that it cannot be shaken by anything. We built this house on love and a joyous sense of community. We built this house and we turned it into a home even as we wandered in the desert, looking for the bricks and wood to make our vision whole. We built this house on the rock of our dreams and we carried it in our hearts. We built this house. and we have come home. Please join me now in a few moments of silence, meditation, or the spirit of prayer.
Reading is The Master Carpenter, A Parable About Integrity by Michael Josephson. A master carpenter who had worked for the same builder for nearly 50 years announced that he was ready to retire. The builder told him how much he appreciated his work, and he gave the carpenter a $5,000 bonus and asked him if he would build just one more house. You see, the builder owned a magnificent lot with a spectacular view, and he wanted to build a dream home. The carpenter was bitterly disappointed at the tiny bonus and the greedy request for still more work. But his last building fee would help him to buy a small cottage, and so he agreed to build the dream house. The carpenter had always prided himself on his uncompromising commitment to quality, but his new resentment of the builder caused him to cut corners, ignore details, and accept shoddy workmanship from other workers. He even looked the other way when some of them substituted cheaper materials and pocketed the difference. When the house was finished, the builder took the old carpenter's hand, and with a huge smile, he gave him an envelope with a thank you card and a folded piece of paper. The carpenter was disdainful until he unfolded the paper and found the deed to the home that he had just built. What a shock! What a shame! If he had only known he was building his own house, he would have done it all differently. Now he had to live in the home he had built none too well. So it is with us. We build our lives in a distracted way, reacting rather than acting, willing to put up with less than the best. At important points, we do not give the job our best effort. Then with a shock, we look at the situation we have created and find that we are now living in the house we have built. If we had realized that, we would have done it all differently. You are the carpenter. Think about your house. Each day you hammer a nail, place a board, or erect a wall. Build wisely. It is the only life you will ever build. Even if you only live it for one day longer, that day deserves to be lived graciously and with dignity. The plaque on the wall says, "Life is a do-it-yourself project. Your life tomorrow will be the result of the attitudes and the tiny choices that you make today. Please stand and by your spirit and join us in singing hymn 346. Come sing a song with me.
Pliny the Elder famously said, "Home is where the heart is." And Robert Frost said, "Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in." Oliver Wendell Holmes got a little more specific, saying, "Where we love is home. Home that our feet may leave, but never our hearts." I like Billy Sunday, who said that home is the place we love the best and grumble about the most. And Tad Williams got really specific when he said, "Never make your home in a place. Make a home for yourself inside your own head. You'll find what you need to furnish it, memory, friends you can trust, love of learning, and other such things. That way it goes with you wherever you go." For generations, home has been defined in dictionaries as the place where one lives. And if someone feels at home, they are comfy in their surroundings. The word home itself comes from both the Old English ham, or village, and the Old High German heim, or dwelling place. But in the quotes above and in our lives today, there is a disconnect, a duality around the idea of home. It's the place that shelters us from the elements. It's the place where we feel safe and comfortable and loved. And quite often, it is not both of these at once. On September 4th in 1929, the American stock market began to fall, and by October 29th, 1929, it had plummeted to the ground in the stock market crash of Black Tuesday. Over the next several years, first the U.S. and then countries around the world plunged into what was known as the Great Depression. A few years later, it all got worse as drought caused the Dust Bowl and black blizzards of blowing dirt swept across our prairies and destroyed any hope of crops. Families from Texas and Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado, and Kansas lost their savings, their ability to earn income, and finally, their homes. Children were sent to live with others. Whole families lived in cars or tents or camps, and they headed out to California to pick fruit and try to survive. They got called Okies, and over 500,000 of them were homeless. Some died, and home was suddenly someplace that you came from, not where you lived. Across the Midwest and New England, things were better, but stories of the Okies were in every paper, and the Great Depression was in full swing. Family after family, even in these better areas, lost fortunes and homes and found themselves living in ways they had never dreamed possible. But our country survived. And by the late 40s and early 50s, we were growing again and the baby boom was on. The children of the Depression were frugal. They had learned the hard way that the littlest things could make huge differences. They saved their money. They planted gardens. And when they were able to, they bought homes again. Now, by 1954, the signs of a successful life were clear. Dad drove a car, maybe even one of those sporty new models in red or blue, yellow or white, maybe even without a top. He wore a suit and tie to work, a crisp white shirt. Two kids were the best. One boy, one girl, of course. And no home was complete without a dog named Spot and a kitten named Ginger or Mittens. Mom stayed at home and was ready with after-school snacks and dinner straight from Betty Crocker. And those homes, a yard for Dad and Billy to mow, big tree outside with a swing and a treehouse. Susie was supposed to have tea parties in the shade, and everything had a white picket fence. The inside was Mom, and the outside was Dad, and every couple could be king and queen of their own realm. And everyone had a bedroom to sleep in, and a family room to relax in, and a garage to park their car. Home again became a place where you lived and where you felt safe and warm. As a nation, we were ferocious about creating a normal for everyone to aspire to. And with the birth of television, more and more people could see how home was supposed to go. Our focus had shifted. If we had the right building, and it looked the right way, we must be doing all right. And there came a growing suspicion that if somehow home didn't feel like home, you were doing something wrong. And then came the 60s and the 70s. Hippies and yippies and divorce and the single scene, and television was everywhere. And for the very first time, Americans could weekly see versions of home and lifestyle that did not look like their own. The Jeffersons and the Brady Bunch, Archie and Edith, Dick and Laura Petrie, Rhoda and Mary Tyler Moore, Soap opera showed us mansions and Green Acres showed us farms. We saw the ghetto in Sanford and Son. The 60s told us that a new age was dawning, and the 70s made sure we knew it was all about us. Bachelor pads, shag carpeting and its rape, futuristic home designs and colors like nothing we have ever seen before. Homes with conversation pits and potted ferns and velvet and plastic, ashtrays large enough to use as end tables, mirrors everywhere that you would never expect mirrors to be. Home was where you were comfortable. An extension of yourself that went beyond protection from the elements and spoke to your senses in new ways. Our homes were us. And there was a growing recognition that some of us didn't have what the rest of us had. The civil rights movement let us see the wide divides between races and economic levels. And in the 70s, we first started to look at how to step across those divides. We looked at our neighbors and we figured out how to say, come on into my home. Make yourself at home. We began to learn. We were proud that they found our places as delightful as we did. But the me generation of the 70s became the I generation of the 80s. And then the world began to change faster than it ever had before. By 2001, computers and the internet were popular. 66% of the population had a computer. 53% were on the internet. And at any moment, our cable TV showed us what was happening in every nation in the world. And we all wanted the best because we could see it. House sizes grew and then grew more. Starter castles. McMansions. They started in the 80s. Homes with beautiful entry halls, bonus rooms, floor areas that began over 3,000 feet. These were no longer something that identified you as rich and famous. These were reachable, desirable. We had chandeliers and heated floors, guest suites with kitchens, year-round Christmas tree rooms, and walk-in closets larger than some people's living rooms. And we saw over and over that we could have the best. It could reflect our personal worth, meet our emotional needs. It was home on a scale we had never dreamed of before. And we could get on the internet, and we could look on cable TV, and we could be sure that ours was better than theirs and the same as hers. And then we could invite others to make themselves at home, but not too much at home, because we worked hard for all that we had, and we didn't want it damaged. And we could finance it all without documentation because the bankers trusted us. Or maybe we just trusted them. And then disaster struck. In 2007, the housing bubble burst, and by 2009, we had entered what is now being called the Great Recession. The vultures came home to roost. The beautiful homes that we had built or bought, the homes we had been told were extensions of our personalities, were worth little. And as the recession deepened and the economy began to fade and stumble, it got worse. For decades, banks had relied on homeowners letting everything else go first. But this time it didn't work. People no longer lived near where they worked or shopped. They needed cars to get them places and phones to stay in touch with jobs, computers to reach the world. And they couldn't afford the places they had bought. For the first time since the Great Depression, middle-class families began to lose their homes. First a few and then more. Almost overnight, our dwelling places, the places that sheltered us and reflected who we were in the world were at risk. And for those of us lucky enough or stable enough to keep ours, we watched as our friends, our children, our co-workers and our neighbors were not able to do the same. We had been taught that our houses, our possessions, were us. They defined us, explained us, protected us, and then they were taken away from many of us. Home was no longer a given, and for people across the country, home was no longer where they lived. People need shelter and safety, places for their possessions and their food. But if we learn nothing else from this recession, let us learn that our homes are not buildings. The buildings are simply places that encase something deeper. That sense of warmth and belonging, of love and acceptance. But we're not the first to face this tension. Not the first to have to learn that it's the emotion and the sense of safety that make a home. In 1875 BCE, specifically on Wednesday, January 9th, according to Hebrew scripture, a Hebrew leader named Jacob took his family and went to join his youngest son Joseph in Egypt. And stripped of all the religious elements, the story goes something like this. Years earlier, Joseph, Jacob's youngest and favorite son, was hated by his older half-brothers. Apparently, the kid was a jerk. And they thought he was being financially favored by their father. The older brothers conspired together and solved the whole problem by selling the spoiled little brat to the nearest passing slave traders bound for Egypt. They waved goodbye without a thought. And they told Jacob the child had been eaten by wild animals and never really gave it another thought. Years passed and there was a terrible famine in their country, Canaan, and to save them all from starvation, a delegation of the brothers went to Egypt themselves to beg. But when they got there, their youngest brother had become the Pharaoh's prime minister and the man who decided how the stored grain would be distributed. He recognized his brothers, even though they didn't know him, and after playing a few really bad jokes on them, he called for the whole family to just come to Egypt to avoid death. The rest of their tribe followed soon afterwards. This is actually what began the period that today gets called the Egyptian captivity. 430 years that the Hebrews lived in Egypt. And you have to remember, this was a terrifying thing for these people. Their homes were in the fields and mountains of Canaan, which today would be Israel, part of Palestine, Lebanon, western parts of Jordan and Syria. Their home was the land itself. And the worst part was, their God lived there too. Before the Egyptian period, the Canaanite god, Yahweh, was a local god of a mountain, a war god. When the Hebrews asked in Psalm 137, "How can we sing the Lord's songs in a foreign land?" they were asking a real and heart-wrenching question. They had left the land where their God lived. They weren't sure what would happen if they called on him somewhere else. Would fire rain from the sky? Would they die? Would he answer? Would there be nothing there at all? Their homes were no longer their place of comfort. Their homes were not where their spirituality found its strength. And they stayed for 400 years, working for the Egyptians for food and clothing, so they could raise their temples and educate their sons. And over time, they got used to it. Their sons began to marry women who worshipped Baal and Amun. Their daughters started to smile and wave at men who were not circumcised and who ate pork and shellfish and worshipped the golden calf. And children began to be born who were given Egyptian names, not Hebrew. Names like Moses and Asir, Pasher, Ophini, Venus. But in 1445 BCE, Egypt was brought to her knees by a series of natural disasters. Algae grew on the Nile, and the algae bloom was known as red tide. It turned the waters as red as blood, killed the fish by the hundreds of thousands, and allowed the normally moderate frog population to explode in numbers. Frogs were sacred to an Egyptian goddess, and they couldn't be killed. So as the dead fish rotted, the water fouled, people got sick. The water and vegetation drew bugs and then larvae. Stable flies multiplied, attacking people and livestock, and passing a disease called glanders, which made people deathly sick. A once-in-a-thousand-year hailstorm poured hail on the already troubled land, killing grain that hadn't been harvested. And the changing winds funneled locusts down into the region and decimated even the stored food. Those same winds brought sky-blackening dust storms and coated stored food. Unfortunately, the coated grain held warmth. Black mold started to grow, and when that grain was eaten by the weakest of all, the firstborn male children, who were fed in an effort to keep them alive, they died from the tainted food. The Egyptians had had about enough, and when a young Hebrew leader named Moses, determined to keep his people from being absorbed by Egyptian culture, when Moses asked if Pharaoh minded if they all left, the answer was basically, do not let the door hit you by. Moses got together every Hebrew he could find and left the Nile Delta, heading for the Promised Land, heading for home. A place where they could be safe, where their dwellings could once again be where they felt happy. They never realized it would take them 40 years to get there. They wandered the Sinai Peninsula in lands that belonged to other people. Sometimes they were received well, and sometimes they had to run like heck. And every night they built sukkah, huts of sticks and vegetation, rugs and cloth, places to house themselves and their children, homes, if only for the night. And it came to them as they wandered that the sukkah were indeed homes, that it was not about the place or the construction, the finery or the design. Home was where their hearts were, where the people they loved were. After 40 years of wandering, they crossed the River Jordan and found the land they were looking for, a place to call their own. And their story is the story of all of us. Home is where we are loved, where we were free to be ourselves, where we will not be turned away. Here at LCUUC, you discovered this for yourselves. As this church family was built year by year, place by place, wandering in Wisconsin without a pillar of fire in sight, together you made a home. And then you made a leap of faith and brought that home and that heart here to this building. In the midst of a great recession, here you have joined your dwelling and your love and made a home where everyone is welcome. Here you can say, not come and share what is mine, but come and see what is all of ours. How do we find our way home? We search our hearts for those places and spaces where we are most truly alive, where we can be ourselves and know we are loved, where we covenant together to learn and grow, where we are respected for being human. McMansion or sukkah hut, cathedral or unique round wooden church with limited windows, it doesn't matter. Home is where our hearts are. And for everyone here today, welcome home. Amen.
extinguish this chalice. And we know that wherever we go, the warmth and light of this congregation will always lead us home. Please stand and bow your spirit and join in singing hymn 1018 in the turquoise book, Come and Go With Me. And please remain standing after the benediction.
It be so.